Today is Tuesday, June 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirms America's commitment to its NATO allies.
I just want all of Europe to know that the United States is there.
Plus, the trial of Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi begins.
They will finish each charge for Aung San Suu Kyi within 180 days.
And potential progress in the prevention of dengue fever. We'll have these stories and more next. The 30 member states of NATO ended their Monday summit in Brussels, reaffirming the military alliance with a strong statement against Russia and, to a lesser degree, China. And U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed his nation's pledge to militarily defend Washington's European allies. Reuters' Zachary Goldman starts us off.
U.S. President Joe Biden offered an unequivocal commitment to defend fellow NATO countries on Monday.
Article 5, we take as a sacred obligation.
Article 5 is the mutual defense clause of the military alliance.
I just want all of Europe to know that the United States is there.
The members are in Brussels for an annual summit. Biden sought to rally Western allies to support a U.S. strategy to contain China's military rise and present a united front in the face of Russian aggression. Allied leaders are concerned about Russia's recent military buildup near Ukraine, as well as its covert and cyber attacks to undermine Western states. Moscow denies any wrongdoing. Beijing, while not seen as an outright adversary, is no longer seen as a benign trading partner. Here's how NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg put it.
China does not share our values. We see how they crack down on democratic protests in Hong Kong. All of this matters for our security.
Another topic at the NATO summit is the handover of power in Washington. Biden's predecessor disparaged the alliance as obsolete, harangued members to pay more for mutual defense, and sometimes appeared to cozy up to their number one adversary, Moscow. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte seemed relieved to see the U.S. administration once again committed to the principles of the defense pact.
I also was able to work with Trump. Of course, it was a bit more awkward sometimes, but I think with Joe Biden, it's more natural again.
Biden will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva on Wednesday.
Zachary Goldman from Reuters. Looking ahead to that Wednesday meeting between President Biden and President Putin, the two leaders are expected to discuss ways to normalize relations that have become increasingly tense. Charles Maines has that part of the story.
Over his two decades in power, Russian President Vladimir Putin has watched as American presidents, both Democrats and Republicans, promise to reset relations with Moscow, only to see the grievances pile up.
The agenda is so complex. The agenda is so overloaded with different issues. The dialogue is needed for the sake of the dialogue.
President Biden initiated this latest effort, saying he wants to put U.S.-Russian relations on a more stable, predictable footing. But the gesture came after the American leader in March labeled Putin a killer in a TV interview, causing outrage in Moscow, and as the Kremlin massed tens of thousands of Russian troops along Ukraine's border. Political observers say the events prove that Putin can't be ignored by Biden.
Why meet with a killer? You meet with leaders that you have no choice but to meet with for the sake of global security. So Putin is satisfied having won this round and a meeting, whatever they do or don't discuss.
Putin has since expressed hope the summit will help normalize ties.
We'll discuss bilateral relations. I think we should try to find a way to resolve these relations. At the moment, they are at an extremely low level.
Behind the animosity, American anger over Russia's alleged interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections that led to tit-for-tat sanctions and diplomatic expulsions. Also, U.S. accusations that Russia is behind recent cyber attacks on American infrastructure, another charge Moscow denies. In fact, the Kremlin argues it's the U.S. who interferes, an accusation it has used to justify a crackdown on growing discontent at home and against pro-Western uprisings in neighboring states like Belarus.
My understanding is that Putin needs America as an enemy for domestic purposes. But at the same time, he needs America as a partner in the international level.
Indeed, the two sides have shown they can bridge differences when it comes to more global issues such as arms control, extending the New START treaty in the first days of the Biden administration. And barring a surprise deal, many view an agreement to return expelled diplomats as a likely way to continue the conversation beyond Geneva and towards better days to come. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
The United States is not planning to support Afghan forces with airstrikes after the U.S. troops withdrawal is complete. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb sat down for an exclusive interview with U.S. CENTCOM Commander General Frank McKenzie.
That's right, Steve. And the counterterrorism strikes in Afghanistan, he said, is going to be limited just to instances when attack plans have been discovered to strike the U.S. homeland or the homelands of our allies.
That would be the reason for any strikes that we do in Afghanistan after we leave. It would have to be that we've uncovered someone who wants to attack the homeland of the United States, one of our allies and partners. That would be the reason for a strike that goes into Afghanistan. I would tell you that the foundation for our planning has been we want to prevent attacks from being generated from Afghanistan against the homeland of the United States. So those are the types of things that we would be looking for.
So the general's comments appear to be refuting a report by the New York Times, which said the Pentagon was actually considering to seek for authorization to carry out airstrikes in case Kabul or perhaps another major city became in danger of falling to the Taliban. That, based on what McKenzie has told me, the general has told me, just does not appear to be true. And it was a very candid description of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, a candid description that, honestly, we have not yet received from the Pentagon. And I was actually speaking with the former CENTCOM commander, retired General Joseph Votel, earlier, and he said of all the things that are left wide open in this Afghanistan withdrawal, of all the things that we're still not certain of all the things we're missing, he said the most important thing that needed to be done is that the U.S. needed to be honest with the Afghan people about what they were going to do and what they were not going to do. So this appears to be General McKenzie coming out and saying this is what the U.S. is going to do moving forward.
Speaking of moving forward, part of your exclusive interview with General McKenzie revolved around the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. Let's listen to the general discuss the logistics.
Coming out of Afghanistan the way we are right now is a significant effort. General Scott Miller, as you know, is our commander on the ground who's running that operation. It requires also help from all the other elements of the United States Department of Defense, particularly U.S. Transportation Command, flies the jets in to haul our people, our equipment out, and also assist with our partners that have been with us for so long in this fight. It is a major event, and what we want to do is we want to make sure force protection is first as we do it. So we pay a lot of attention to that, making sure that our men and women are safe as they execute these operations and we actually bring them out.
Carla, can you kind of expand on what the general had to say, not only about the withdrawal, but also U.S. troop numbers?
So this new number that we're hearing, this approximately 40,000 U.S. troops in the Middle East, this is a significant reduction from just 18 months ago when that number was between 60,000 and 80,000 troops. Of course, if you remember that time, we were wondering every day if the United States and Iran were going to go to war. It was a very, very tense time. There was a huge ramping up of forces. Now it appears that the United States is slowly but steadily pulling out some forces from the Central Command area of responsibility in an effort to refocus, as the president and as the Secretary of Defense have been very clear about, to refocus on China. In fact, since President Joe Biden took office, he has ordered the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, as we all know. He's cut U.S. military support for the Saudi-led offensive against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. And meanwhile, the Pentagon has been moving ships and weapon systems and troops out of the Middle East. McKenzie knew that. He was very clear-eyed about what was going on. And he said, this is going to be a tough time for not only U.S. Central Command, but also U.S. Transportation Command. That's the command in the Pentagon that moves all of the pieces, the military pieces around, whether it's people, whether it's assets, because he acknowledged that this withdrawal from Afghanistan has put a huge strain on the Pentagon. There is an aircraft carrier right now, the USS Dwight Eisenhower, that has been carrying out strikes in the Arabian Sea, sitting out there because the Arabian Sea is the closest place to Afghanistan to conduct strikes. All of the other strikes, if they don't come from that aircraft carrier, have to come from thousands of kilometers away in places like Qatar, in places like the UAE. So all of this is going on to safely get out U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And he explained that once all U.S. forces are out, that's a lot of bandwidth. That's a long way to continue these strikes. And so the U.S. is just not going to be continuing these strikes in support of the Afghan forces. They are going to be continuing strikes against Al-Qaeda, against ISIS. And so we're not clear how this is going to move forward. And I pushed him on this because, as we all know, Al-Qaeda is still linked to the Taliban. That's been a lot of discussions about Afghanistan lately. The UN report just reiterated that recently. And so here's what he had to say about that.
We do have basic solutions. I don't want to share them with you right now for reasons that you'll understand. But we do have basic solutions. They're a long way away. But they do work for us and will allow us to keep the pressure up. Again, it will be hard to do. It's not impossible to do.
He did clear up some of the question marks while he was speaking with me. The Afghan Air Force, how the U.S. will provide maintenance to them, that has been a big question that has not been fully flushed out. He made sure that was clear. He said that the United States is going to help maintain the Afghan aircraft through a combination of virtual advising from afar and then flying parts in and out of the country. And then I pushed him back and I said, that's going to undoubtedly slow the maintenance process. And so he admitted, yes, the risks are going to be greater. They're going to be significantly greater, but there's not going to be a base in Afghanistan. The United States is going down to zero troops in Afghanistan. That's what the president of the United States has said that he wants. And the only U.S. forces that are going to remain in Afghanistan are going to be the ones that are securing the base in Kabul. So the one big question mark that remains is who is going to protect that airport in Kabul, that airport that is necessary for the United States and other Western allies to have their bases. And the understanding was that the Turks were going to continue to provide security. But President Joe Biden met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Monday, and that seems to still be unclear what's going to happen there. So we're going to have to wait and see if the Turks decide that they will provide the security, or perhaps the Americans or even other allies will have to step in to help secure Kabul.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. She spoke to me from Italy after her exclusive interview with U.S. CENTCOM Commander General Frank McKenzie. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. In past years, pilgrims and tourists have flocked to Aksum, a holy city in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Today, many of its streets are quiet and many businesses are closed due to more than 7 months of war involving the national government and a regional political party that led the ruling coalition for 3 decades. Continuing battles in the countryside are deepening the strain on the city. And Heather Murdoch takes it from here.
For Ethiopian Orthodox Christians, more than 40% of the country's population and most of the people in the Tigray region, Aksum is the holiest city in the world. They believe it to be home to the Ark of the Covenant, or original Ten Commandments, and the birthplace of Ethiopian Christianity.
I come to church to receive forgiveness. God will protect the Ark.
But after more than 7 months of war, many worshippers here are displaced families from the countryside. War victims continue to flood the hospital.
We were doing construction work, filling concrete columns when the building was bombed, and I was hit by shrapnel. In this leg, and then again in this one.
Hospital administrators say besides those injured from battles, mortality rates in the region are going up because healthcare centers are damaged and or looted, and many roads to hospitals in the main cities are cut. Aksum residents say sporadic violence continues as businesses slowly reopen.
If we do not open our shops, we may die from hunger. Things are changing in this war. People used to flee cities for the country, but now displaced people are coming here, and we have to take care of them. We have to open to survive.
Many businesses were looted in the extreme violence that rained down on the city late last year, which locals say killed hundreds of civilians. And fighting continues between soldiers of the Ethiopian Defense Forces and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Eritrean soldiers are fighting in support of the federal military, and both sides have militias in the fray. The violence began in November 2020, when TPLF forces attacked federal military bases in Tigray, and Ethiopian forces swept through the region. Thousands have been killed, and millions have been displaced. And while the government says Tigray is in the process of recovering, many locals say their security and economic situation are deteriorating. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Aksum, Ethiopia.
As the conflict continues in Tigray, the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, released some grim numbers. The organization said that at least 33,000 children in inaccessible parts of Tigray are severely malnourished and face imminent death without immediate help. UNICEF added that over 140,000 people are already facing famine-like conditions, and some 56,000 children under the age of five are projected to be in need of care for severe acute malnutrition. Kenneth Kaunda, Zambia's first post-colonial president who ruled the country for 27 years, has been hospitalized. Reuters reporter David Doyle has more.
The 97-year-old is receiving treatment for an undisclosed illness at a military hospital in the capital, Lusaka. His administrative assistant, Roger Kungolo, said Kaunda had been feeling unwell and had requested all Zambians and the international community to pray for him. Kaunda ruled Zambia from 1964, when the Southern African nation won independence from Britain, until 1991. Incumbent President Edgar Lungu urged Zambians to pray so that God can touch him with his healing hand. He said Kaunda had stood up for Zambia at the critical moment, so we can all stand up for him in his moment of weakness.
Reuters' David Doyle. The first woman, the first African, and only the second chief prosecutor of the still young International Criminal Court, Gambia's Fatou Bensouda, leaves office Tuesday, both praised for pushing The Hague's tribunal's boundaries as a court of last resort and skewered for key setbacks under her watch. Under her 9-year tenure, Bensouda secured groundbreaking convictions, including the first ever indictment defining an attack on cultural heritage as a war crime. But she also lost high-profile cases against Ivory Coast ex-president Laurent Gbagbo, as well as former Congolese vice president Jean-Pierre Bemba. Myanmar's ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi went on trial Monday. As VOA Burmese service chief Tan Luen Tun tells me, it's the first trial date of many more to come.
Today, the appearance is after the agreement with the presiding judge that they will finish each charge for Aung San Suu Kyi within 180 days. So today, they are mainly looking at two charges. It is about violation of the environmental, which is a COVID regulation violation, and also about telecommunication charge. So COVID violation, as you know, that there's some sort of regulation for not gathering outside during the COVID or something like that. She was said to have been violated to go outside of her residence and support people rallying for an election or something like that. And then the most interesting thing is about today's charges is that telecommunication act. So using illegally imported walkie-talkies. What kind of walkie-talkies they are talking about, we don't know. But what I learned is that there's been a few walkie-talkie set confiscated at her residence, which has said have been used by the hard security, details. And it's very, very quite strange that hard security details has been provided. It was provided by the state. And why that was a kind of that kind of charge, we don't know. We're not very clear about that.
Lewin, Aung San Suu Kyi is back in court on Tuesday. As you mentioned, they're taking her charges almost one by one to try and finish within this time period that the court has set aside. What can you tell us about the court appearance scheduled for Tuesday? What kind of charges are they going to be discussing? And ultimately, if she's convicted, how much time in prison would she be looking at?
You know that if the schedules are a bit funny, I have to say that even lawyer doesn't know that what kind of schedules and what kind of charges will be taken up at the time. But among those seven charges we know of, is that two of the charges are the most serious, which is corruption charges, and then another one is violation of state secret act. So each charges carry a maximum of 15 years in prison sentence. So for me, and I don't know about the violation of state secret. What was a little bit of disclosed was that it is related to the financial or some sort of information through that one of our Australian economic advisor, Sean Turner. So it was related to him. This is vaguely we knew about it. But another one we knew is definitely is just last week press conference by the military regime. It disclosed that Government Anti-Corruption Commission make a charge against Aung San Suu Kyi that she's being receiving bribe and then also using her position to acquire some sort of land and buildings for her foundation, which is in the name of her mother. And also there was a kind of a video confession by the Rangoon Division Chief Minister, and which is a very high-ranking official, in a video confession that he bribed Aung San Suu Kyi for nearly $6 million plus about seven gold bars or something like that. So there's no statement from Aung San Suu Kyi and other people from that the defendant side, but these are the charges. They are quite serious.
Tan Lewin Tan is the chief of the VOA Burmese service. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN officials warn that Lebanon is at the point of collapse as it struggles to overcome one of the worst economic financial crises in its history. Lisa Schlein has those details.
Lebanon not long ago was considered a high middle-income country, but now the country is battling hyperinflation, which is eroding the value of the national currency and people's purchasing power, thus further impoverishing a large segment of its population. UN Resident Coordinator and Humanitarian Coordinator for Lebanon, Najat Rushdie, says more than a million Lebanese need relief assistance to cover their basic needs, including food. Additionally, she notes more than a million Syrian refugees and 270,000 Palestinian refugees need direct emergency aid to survive. She adds acute malnutrition rates among young children is increasing, and at least 1.2 million children have had their schooling interrupted for more than a year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. She says the situation for ordinary people is worsening every day. She adds people are adopting negative coping mechanisms such as cutting down on daily meals to survive.
Lebanon is grappling with an economic and financial meltdown. The spillover effects of the ongoing Syrian crisis and a political deadlock that is fueling popular protests and blocking any possibility of meaningful reforms and recovery.
Rushdie blames a breakdown of public services on the economic crisis as well as political gridlock and a governance vacuum. She says too many people are unable to access health, electricity, water, the internet, and other essential services. She notes Lebanon has been without a government for nearly 10 months. She says Lebanon's leaders have ignored repeated pleas by the UN and the international community to form a new cabinet.
International community have warned with increasing urgency that without a government that can implement meaningful structural reforms, no investment will be made beyond the necessary urgent and early recovery aid. The lack of an empowered government has already severely impeded Lebanon's capacity to tackle the decisions, policies, and reforms required to avert the country's collapse.
Rushdie says the UN and international community agree the responsibility for averting a deeper crisis rests with the Lebanese leadership. She says they are calling on them to ensure that parliamentary and municipal elections go ahead next year as planned. She says no one wants Lebanon to slide into a full-scale humanitarian catastrophe. However, to prevent that from happening, she says the country's leaders must bring about change and implement the much-needed reforms the soonest possible. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Novavax Incorporated on Monday reported late-stage data from its U.S.-based clinical trial showing its vaccine is more than 90% effective against COVID-19 across a variety of variants of the virus. Emer McCarthy from Reuters reports.
The Maryland-based company said the study of nearly 30,000 volunteers in the United States and Mexico puts Novavax on track to file for emergency authorization in the U.S. and elsewhere in the third quarter this year. Novavax's protein-based COVID-19 vaccine candidate was more than 93% effective against the predominant variants of COVID-19 that have been worrying scientists and public health officials. It said that during the trial, the B117 variant, first discovered in Britain, became the most common variant in the United States. Head of Research and Development Dr. Gregory Glenn told Reuters that the company also detected variants first found in Brazil, South Africa, and India among its trial participants. The vaccine was 91% effective among volunteers at high risk of severe infection and 100% effective in preventing moderate and severe cases of COVID-19. It was roughly 70% effective against COVID-19 variants that Novavax was unable to identify. Novavax says it's on track to produce 100 million doses per month by the end of the third quarter of 2021 and 150 million doses per month in the fourth quarter of this year. Back in May, Novavax said it had begun its regulatory filing in India in partnership with the Serum Institute of India, which is contracted to make Novavax shots.
Reuters' Emer McCarthy. And finally, a report published in the New England Journal of Medicine shows the potentially life-saving results of lab-grown mosquitoes. Infected with bacteria, the insects may no longer have the ability to transmit dengue fever. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Researchers at this lab in Rio de Janeiro filter larvae from mosquitoes infected with Wolbachia bacteria. The infection may prevent transmission of viruses like dengue. Researcher Dr. Bettina Durovny explains this may just be the beginning.
The first experiments were with dengue. More recently, studies have been published showing that it also has the capacity to reduce the transmission of Zika and chikungunya. What we are doing now is transferring this knowledge of basic sciences to expand this to protect the populations. And the results that we are observing are showing a reduction.
Researchers infect and release mosquitoes into regions of countries like Australia, Brazil, Indonesia, and Vietnam. They then measure those areas against control group communities outside the regions with Wolbachia mosquitoes. Durovny explains.
We compare the areas that we treated with the areas that weren't, and these areas have been similar through time. So what we do is compare the areas that we treated with the areas that weren't. The areas that weren't treated function as a control. Our expectation is we need at least 3 years to have more consistency with the results while building this evidence.
Researchers say it's too soon to know what effects large-scale modified insects could have on the ecosystem. But for now, the results of an Indonesian study recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine show a 77% drop in the incidence of dengue, and the number of people who'd normally need hospital care from the virus fell by 86%. The studies led by scientists at the World Mosquito Program will expand to Colombia, Sri Lanka, India, and the Western Pacific. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.